New Zealand on Saturday marked the second anniversary of one of its most traumatic days when 51 worshippers were killed at two Christchurch mosques by a white supremacist gunman. Several hundred people gathered at the Christchurch Arena for the remembrance service, which was also live streamed. A similar service planned for last year was canceled due to the coronavirus. In the March 15, 2019 attacks, Australian Brenton Tarrant killed 44 people at the Al Noor Mosque during Friday prayers before driving to the Linwood Mosque, where he killed seven more. Last year, Tarrant pleaded guilty to 51 counts of murder, 40 counts of attempted murder, and one count of terrorism. He was sentenced to life in prison without parole. The city of Minneapolis in the U.S. agreed to pay $27 million to settle a civil lawsuit from George Floyd's family over the black man's death in police custody. Council members met privately to discuss the settlement, then returned to public session for a unanimous vote in support of the massive payout. Floyd family attorney Ben Crump called it the largest pre-trial settlement ever for a civil rights claim and thanked city leaders for showing you care about George Floyd. Floyd was declared dead on May 25, 2020, after Derek Chauvin, who was white, pressed his knee against his neck for about 9 minutes. Floyd's death sparked sometimes violent protests in the U.S. and beyond and led to reckonings on racial justice. Australia on Saturday recorded its first local COVID-19 case in more than 2 weeks after a doctor tested positive for the UK variant of the coronavirus, triggering restrictions in area hospitals. This is VOA News. Former Bolivian President Jeanine Añez has been arrested for alleged involvement in a coup against longtime leftist leader Evo Morales in 2019, the socialist government said on Saturday. Morales resigned and fled Bolivia in 2019 amid fierce protests against his government and allegations of electoral fraud. Añez, a former senator, took over as interim president by default, but 11 months later, Morales' Socialist Party returned to power in elections. Those elections were last October. A government minister said the public prosecutor's office issued an arrest warrant for Añez due to the case of a coup in our country, a claim Morales, who was president for nearly 14 years, has long made against his conservative political opponent. Añez's response was that the political persecution has begun and that there was no coup, but a constitutional secession due to electoral fraud. The United States is resuming humanitarian assistance to Yemen's rebel-held north to counter a looming famine in the country. U.S. Yemen envoy Tim Linderking made that announcement. A Saudi-led coalition has been fighting since 2015 to dislodge Iran-allied Houthi rebels who've seized much of Yemen's north. The administration of former President Donald Trump cut much of its aid to Yemen last year, saying the Houthis were diverting humanitarian assistance to themselves. U.S. officials say they are resuming the aid with new measures and monitoring to try to make sure the relief gets to the civilians who actually need it. In the U.S., more than 1,000 National Guard members will be leaving Washington over the weekend, but several thousand others will stay on for days or weeks in the ongoing mission to provide security for the U.S. Capitol that has drawn criticism from lawmakers and reluctance from the military. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin earlier this week approved the Capitol Police request to extend the deployment of nearly 2,300 Guard members for about 2 more months because possible threats of violence do remain. And challengers Luna Rossa beat Team New Zealand in the fifth race of the 36th America's Cup off the coast of Auckland on Saturday, crossing the line 18 seconds ahead of the holders to take a 3-2 lead in the best of 13 match. The contest had initially been delayed. It continues later today with race number 6. Via remote, Laurel Bowman, VOA News.
From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week via Skype, Kimberly Adams, correspondent for Marketplace, Richard Lautendress, correspondent for TVA Nouvelle Canada, and our moderator, Shayna Estulin, political and foreign affairs correspondent.
Welcome to the show. Here are the issues we will be covering. President Biden scores his first major legislative win as Congress passes a massive COVID relief bill with no support, though, from Republicans. We mark 1 year since the official start of the pandemic here in the U.S. We'll look back at what it was like in those early days, what we have been through this past year, and what we could be expecting in the coming months. Plus, the U.S. expands sanctions against the leader of the military coup in Myanmar as a deadly crackdown on protests continue in that country, and the U.S. Secretary of State warning more action could be coming. Richard, Kimberly, it's a pleasure to talk to both of you again. We really could use your analysis and wisdom tackling the big stories of the week, so I'm glad you're on the show. I want to start with the action taken by Congress passing a massive COVID relief bill. $1.9 trillion, that's the number to know. It's a very big number. In fact, this is the largest standalone stimulus package ever passed in American history, the largest. So, Kimberly, what's in it?
There's another round of direct stimulus or relief payments that will go out to most Americans, about $1,400, that will immediately give people some cash in the bank or in their pockets, depending on how they interact with the financial system. There's also expansions to tax credits for low-wage workers as well as families with children, and some of that money will actually be potentially coming even earlier than tax season when it usually arrives. There's more money for small businesses, a small expansion of the Paycheck Protection Program, but also new programs to help some of the worst hit segments of the economy, like entertainment venues and restaurants. A lot of money is going to be going, I think something like $350 billion, going to state and local governments to shore up their own programs, money to help reopen schools. This really is going to spread in a lot of different ways throughout the economy.
And yet, Richard, no Republicans, zero, supported this bill. Why not? What are their arguments?
Well, their main point fundamentally is that it's not a rescue or a relief plan. It's fundamentally a long list of old-fashioned left-wing priorities, according to them. They see this as a way to use money for Democratic priorities while there's still money from other plans that were voted last year that should be first used. There's this new interest in bringing down the deficit and bringing down the debt that wasn't there during the previous years, but suddenly they come up with this idea. There's also the impression that since we're seeing, even if it's not yet totally clear, fewer cases, more vaccination, restrictions are lifted, business are reopening, there's the impression that it could also overstimulate the economy with a risk of inflation. So there's definitely a ideological attitude on the Republican side, no vote on the Senate side, no vote on the House side, but the president wants to go ahead anyway.
A lot of good points you mentioned there. One of them being that this could do, like you said, overstimulate the economy, that the economy doesn't need a bill this large, and it could spark inflation, which would have its own economic repercussions. Kimberly, is the White House addressing any of these concerns, or is this sort of sell it to the American public that everything in this bill is good?
The White House is addressing it. The Federal Reserve is addressing it. And their response is basically, it's not that big of a deal. They say that inflation concerns are overblown. And even if there is inflation, we've heard from the Federal Reserve, our central bank, that they still believe that they have enough tools in their toolkit to be able to put a stop to inflation if it starts to get too crazy. But the Biden administration has consistently said that they are willing to accept the risk of overstimulating the economy if it means getting more of this cash out the door. And, you know, as Richard was just saying, advancing some of these priorities that they might not be able to pass on their own. One of the things of having such a closely divided Congress with the slimmest of majorities for the Democrats is that it makes it very hard to pass traditional legislation. So there was a big push to get as much of these Democratic priorities, especially the expensive ones, into this one piece of legislation. And I think we're going to be seeing similar moves with some of the other legislation coming down the pipeline.
The White House seems to be embracing this criticism that it's a liberal wish list. Like, yeah, exactly right. We want to expand the social safety net for this country, and that's precisely what we're trying to do. At this point, the bill is popular, according to polls. But that could change depending on how it's sort of implemented. If there's any corruption or misspending, or Americans don't get the money quick enough, or a big issue, if schools don't open fast enough, that positive sentiment can also change, Richard. So we are seeing the White House continue to try to sell this. What steps are they taking around that?
Well, it's just the beginning, Shana. So the president is going to give his first primetime speech on Thursday. And in there, he's going to go over the year we've gone through. We're going to talk about it a little later. But with the pandemic, the sacrifices that were made, the people who were lost, he will also bring back, insist on what this American Rescue Plan will do to restart something that will look like a normal life. And then the traveling around the country. The White House has insisted on this. Starting on Tuesday in Pennsylvania, the president is going to sell his plan to the Americans. Joe Biden, when he was vice president of Barack Obama, the lesson is taken out of the way the Health Care Act, the Obamacare, was sold. It was not dynamic enough. Even also the rescue plans after the Great Recession, everything that the Obama administration did was too low key for him, and he doesn't want to make the same mistake this time. So we've been promised that not only the president, but the vice president, the first gentleman, the first lady, they will travel the country to tell the American how this is going to be helpful to them. And the fact that they also at the White House in Congress insist on the fact that it goes further than just checks being given all around the place, as Kimberly described so well, but it's fundamentally fighting poverty. Child poverty could be cut in half. And these are clear changes to the reality of Americans that could probably help stop people criticizing the details of this program. There was some fraud here or some excesses there. The fact that it will not only have an impact on Americans' health, but the American economy at large.
Right. And at the same time, Republicans will be selling or trying to sell to the American public why this is a disaster, that it's overly expensive, it's poorly targeted, it's bailing out blue states for mismanagement before the pandemic. So this is certainly going to be talking points that we're going to be hearing over and over from both sides. And speaking about both sides, I think both of you sort of mentioned that Biden and the Democrats really went at this alone. I mean, there was some attempt in the beginning, Kimberly, to bring Republicans on board, as we've been talking about, no Republican support for this. So what does that dynamic mean going forward for other pieces of legislation that Biden would like to pass?
I think it does a couple of things. First of all, it signals to Republicans that the Biden administration will go it alone. So if they want any part of some of these bigger legislative priorities, that they may have a stronger incentive to compromise. On the other hand, as we were just discussing, the power of rhetoric is very strong, especially leading up to the midterm elections. So a lot of Republicans may feel it's in their better interest just to say, no, we are going to continue to block all of these initiatives rather than get a compromise or some version of what we want. We feel it's better to just say no and stop them from advancing larger packages, because without any Republican support, the best they can do are these budget reconciliation bills. And those have a lot of restrictions I won't get into right now. But the point being is that saying no still limits the legislative agenda in some ways, but refusing to engage also means that what does get through will have very little Republican input moving forward.
Very good point. And yeah, I don't think we have enough time to do budget reconciliation and get in the weeds there. But that is the way this was passed, and that's why they were able to do it without Republican support. I just want to bring up a figure that I've been reading. This is now the sixth COVID relief package to pass in the past year. Between what Congress has approved and what the Fed has spent, it's more than $6 trillion that's been thrown at the struggling U.S. economy. That is more money than the cost of all of the post-9/11 wars combined on just one pandemic. I mean, Richard, when you hear that sort of how much money has been spent, I mean, it's pretty mind-boggling.
It is, and it's speechless. I mean, it's so interesting, Shannon, when you look at this, We just bring ourselves back before the Trump administration, when it seemed to be a real ideological divide between people favoring government investing in the economy and the other side more into controlling expenses, bringing down the deficits. Now it sounds on both sides, even if we're hearing more and more on the Republican side, the old conservative way of looking at managing public finances. But with the Trump administration, this idea of limiting expenses, no, the place of government in restarting, helping, organizing society is seen as far more fundamental and necessary than, I'm not talking about the 60s or the 50s now, just like 5 years ago. But I think the pandemic is this once in a century moment, event, reality that totally transform the way we want to organize the states. Trying to figure out how are we going to pay for this? You don't want to start thinking about this because it's almost unfathomable how you can organize society to end up paying for this. Thankfully, interest rates are so low that at the moment, it's probably the best time to borrow that amount of money.
Well said. Let's put this to rest, take a break. And when we come back, we'll cover immigration, 1 year since the pandemic began, and what's going on in Myanmar. We'll be right back.
Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also, visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel via Skype. Kimberly Adams, correspondent for Marketplace. Richard Luttendress, correspondent for TVA Nouvelle Canada, and our moderator, Shayna Estulin, political and foreign affairs correspondent.
Welcome back to the show. We're going to be talking about an immigration crisis at the border right now, although the White House doesn't want to use that word. There is an issue going on. In recent weeks, there's been a surge in the number of migrant children trying to get into the U.S. According to the New York Times, the number of migrant children held in federal custody has tripled in recent weeks. The number of migrants trying to get in general are at levels we haven't seen in years. Kimberly, Biden has promised a more humane approach to immigration than his predecessor, Donald Trump. But how difficult is that balancing act given the complicated reality at the border?
This has been the struggle of many administrations, and it's not going to get any easier just because there's a new president in the White House. I mean, very famously, Obama began a large numbers of deportations and was roundly criticized for that. Then when Trump was in office, there were also policies that did indeed prevent people from crossing the border, the Remain in Mexico plans and things like that. And so by ending some of those policies, it did do what some activists say is release pent-up demand. And so this flood that we're seeing are people who were heavily restricted either because of pandemic regulations or through Trump-era policies that the Biden administration believes were deeply problematic, are now able to begin moving through the system. And that does create this surge. Additionally, the coronavirus pandemic is, hesitate to say this, but with the vaccine rollout and lowering hospitalizations, there are lessening fears of people coming into the country. So there's a lot of factors at play. There is not enough infrastructure at the border to handle all of these people, and that infrastructure was underinvested during the Trump administration as a disincentive for people to cross the border. So all of these things coming together are exactly as you said. It makes it a very complicated situation with real human consequences.
You brought up a lot of good points. I mean, the Biden administration has been saying this is a mess they inherited, and Biden has been pleading with immigrants not to come now. But regardless of whose fault it is, at this point, it's Biden's responsibility what happens at the border. And Republicans are really hammering the administration over this, blaming them for overturning Trump's immigration policies. And that's what's causing the surge. Richard, do you see Republicans making this a central issue in their attacks on Biden? And is it a winning issue?
Yes, for making it a central issue against the Biden administration. Yes, a winning issue with their electorate. Donald Trump had a lot of success in 2016 hammering these xenophobic policies. I did not see in the last election, general election, presidential and congressional election, a change within the Republican electorate on this issue. I'm afraid at the moment that the president is paying the price of his campaign, during which he insisted, and surely correctly, that his policy, his immigration policy, is going to be a more humane policy. Jen Psaki, his press secretary, repeats it almost every day. However, the message that was sent on the other side of the border is that, okay, now it's going to be easier to come in. Let's find a way to reach the border of the U.S. and Mexico. And so I'm afraid that even if on one side it was absolutely necessary to go back to something that looks more like American values, but the misery in Central America, the poverty, the violence, the reality of two hurricanes and the economic hardship that came out of there makes it so tempting to leave and to come north. At a certain point, not only technically, logistically, there won't be enough facilities and shelters for all these people, but just restarting this policy of, I'm using the expression of catch and release that is very often used. Unfortunately, I do believe it's going to be a winning argument for the Republicans during the midterms election.
You know, even though the White House is not calling this a crisis, clearly they do realize this is a big problem. You had White House officials down at the border visiting this week, and even if they're promising a more humane approach, when you've got that many kids being held in federal custody, unfortunately, a lot could go wrong. I want to move on to another big story this week. It's been a very important anniversary that a lot of Americans are marking. It's the one-year anniversary since this country started to go into the lockdown that we've been dealing with for the past year. Kim, I've been reading these recaps that news outlets have been putting out, sort of a day-by-day recap of this time last year. And as I'm reading it, as they're talking about how the country began shutting down, schools and businesses starting to close, my throat starts to close as well, because I know what's coming. It's not going to be a couple weeks. This is going to last a very long time. What are your thoughts when we look back at what happened this time last year?
I think back actually to February 26th. I know that March 11th was the day that the World Health Organization labeled this a pandemic. But on March 26th, there was a CDC doctor who gave a press conference and said that she sat down that morning at her breakfast table with her husband and her children and told them that their lives were about to change and that they needed to get ready and that it was going to upend everything. It was so prescient. And there were people who looked at what was going on back in March of last year, knew it was going to be bad, knew how bad it was going to be, knew what we could do to stop it. And one of the saddest things is that it didn't happen. I was on the show March of last year talking about some of those predictions and how bad it could be. And people knew what to do, but there was not the political will to do it. And so when I think about the more than 500,000 people that we've lost, and, you know, I was struck when we were talking earlier about the relief bill, how it's more money than we spent on all of these wars. We've lost more people than we lost in all of those wars. The unemployment situation is unprecedented since the Great Depression, and none of us will ever be the same. Our economy will not be the same. Our mental health situation in this country will never be the same when you think about the compounding effects of a year of grief and stress and parents working from home while trying to juggle the responsibilities of childcare and the fear, living under the cloud of fear for a year, is something that I think will change all of us forever.
And as you point out, different than the wars, we also have, as a country, not been really able to mourn the loss as you would, for instance, those who die in war. You could go to funerals, you can gather with loved ones to grieve together. Just the country has not been able to grieve together. 500,000 people, it's more than that now, just a staggering number. And Richard, I mean, it's been a tough year for everyone. I don't think anyone has really gotten through this year unscathed. The loss of life, the loss of financial security, millions of people getting sick, some still having side effects from being sick. Of course, this is not unique to the United States. This is a global pandemic. How are other countries marking a year into the pandemic? Although I know for some countries, this began earlier than here in the United States.
I think just the way Kimberly and you, Shana, described the reality in the U.S., how shocking it is, you know, 528 million people that we've lost because of this. They look at their own reality. And the fact that here in the U.S., it's 10 million fewer jobs, jobs that have disappeared, people who are not working. And it's the same thing in those countries. I just want to underline this as for myself. Maybe I'm too much of an optimistic, but I'm looking at this. And just as you said, Shannon, you said it was tough for everyone. Well, the only good thing in this is that we were all in this together. The entire planet, we share that together. The sadness and the pain of having lost these people and our lives being transformed, we're starting more or less at the same point looking up at the moment.
And if I can continue the theme of seeing something good, there is some good news coming. I mean, the numbers of people being vaccinated in the U.S. every day, the numbers are at record highs. I mean, I think we've seen 2 million people being given vaccines a day. Public health experts are predicting that by the summer or by the fall, we'll have herd immunity. Kimberly, from just a political point of view, Biden had originally promised that we wouldn't see shots for everyone until the summer. Now he's saying we're going to see that much earlier in May. Do you think that's a deliberate strategy by the Biden administration to sort of underpromise and then overdeliver?
I think the risk of him being wrong and not delivering are so high that the benefit is only to underpromise and overdeliver. I think he made that original announcement before the Johnson & Johnson vaccine had been cleared and before those orders had been secured. And then once that supply came online, it opened the floodgates, you know, in terms of how many people could get vaccinated. I do think it's worthwhile thinking about vaccines, though, from the global perspective, which is that it's really great that the United States is getting all of the supply and all these folks are going to be able to be vaccinated. It will be very interesting to see how the vaccines flow throughout the rest of the world, including some of the less developed nations that don't have the ability to buy the vaccines in the more competitive marketplace. And so the thing that will really control the pandemic and these new variants will be getting this vaccine spread globally and also back here in the United States, making sure that people actually want to take it because of a history of discrimination and bad relations with the medical establishment. A lot of the groups that are most vulnerable to the pandemic here in the U.S., talking about Black people and Hispanic and Latino people, are less likely to want to be vaccinated. And so there have been all of these big public service campaigns to try to convince people to be vaccinated, but that's going to be an ongoing challenge.
Yeah, the White House has been putting some effort into helping with that issue for sure. And then this idea of vaccine diplomacy, as you've been talking about, on a sort of getting vaccines to other countries and some countries taking advantage of the influence they'll have getting vaccines to other countries is something we're going to be watching as well. Just very quickly, we have a couple of minutes left. I want to touch on a global story that continues to get a lot of attention. The U.S. this week expanded sanctions on the leader of the violent military coup in the Southeast Asian country of Myanmar or Burma. It's a country that for a time seemed to be heading towards democracy, but the military last month overthrew the democratically elected government. There's been a deadly crackdown on protests. Dozens of people have been killed. The U.S. is wading in. They have, as I said, they've imposed sanctions and threatening more action. Richard, my question is, why is this country so important to the U.S.?
I think we know that Myanmar in the region has a lot of influence. Myanmar moving towards democracy was inspiring on that side. And I think that the Americans are adopting a certain number of decisions to punish the military and the commander-in-chief, Min Aung Hlaing, and the people around him. But I think they do hope to work, they expect to work at the UN Security Council, at the UN at large, with China to, you know, transform the reality over there. And the simple fact that the ambassador at the UN, the Chinese ambassador at the UN, has called for a de-escalation is a sign that the Americans are not only going to work on sanctions against the military rulers, but are back also in the international sphere to use their allies and their partners to put pressure on the leaders over there.
Yeah, it's such a complicated issue. I mean, it's a strategically important country because it borders with China. China doesn't want to see a democracy in their backyard, but China also has a really uneasy relationship with the Myanmar military. I mean, they both support the military, but they also support rebel groups that fight the military. This is definitely a complex story, lots of moving pieces, and really sort of plays out this competition between the U.S. and China. We certainly don't have enough time to go into it, but thank you for your analysis on that. And that is all the time we have. Thanks to Kimberly Adams, correspondent for Marketplace, and Richard Luxendress, correspondent for TVA Novel Canada. This program is produced by the Voice of America. I'm Shana Stulen. Thanks for listening.
From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our special guest on this edition of the program is Congresswoman Karen Bass, a Democrat from the state of California. She is serving her sixth term in office. According to her website, Karen Bass serves on the House of Representatives Committee on Foreign Affairs, where she chairs the Subcommittee on Africa, Global Health, and Global Human Rights. She has been the top Democrat on that committee since 2011. Bass also serves on the House Judiciary Subcommittee on Crime and Terrorism, where she is active in crafting sound criminal justice reform policies. In that vein, she recently co-introduced the George Floyd Justice in Policing Act, comprehensive legislation designed to hold police accountable, end racial profiling, and change the culture of law enforcement by addressing systemic racism and bias. From 2019 to 2020, Congresswoman Bass was the chair of the Congressional Black Caucus. Last week, the U.S. House of Representatives passed U.S. President Joe Biden's $1.9 trillion COVID-19 relief bill with a vote of 2020 to 2011. The American Rescue Plan is designed to speed up the United States' recovery from the economic and health effects of the COVID-19 pandemic and the ongoing recession. This is a major legislative victory for President Biden less than 2 months into his presidency. The legislation passed along party lines. No Republicans voted in favor, even though public opinion polls reveal it is popular among constituents of both parties. We'll talk with Congresswoman Bass about the significance of this massive COVID relief bill, prospects for the Justice and Policing Act, the status of voting rights, the ramifications of the January 6th insurrection at the U.S. Capitol, and U.S.-Africa relations. Congresswoman Bass joins us via Microsoft Teams as we continue to practice social distancing due to COVID-19. Congresswoman Karen Bass, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Well, Congresswoman Bass, last week was a huge week for the American people. We saw the passage of the American Rescue Plan, the COVID relief bill. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer says this is one of the most consequential pieces of legislation that has been passed in America in decades. There are critics on the Republican side saying it was a costly, corrupt bill. What is your assessment of this legislation? Why is it so significant for your constituents and for the country?
Well, it's significant for the name of the legislation. It is the American Rescue Package because the people of the country need to be rescued from the social, economic, and health impact of the coronavirus. If we had had leadership like this last year, we wouldn't have even had to have spent over $1 trillion. But with a new administration that is absolutely committed to stamping out this disease that has killed over 500,000 Americans. So bringing direct relief to people is what makes this so historic. And I'm sorry that my Republican colleagues don't view it that way. They actually had no problem at all spending the same amount of money, $1.9 trillion, providing tax breaks for the richest Americans a few years ago. And then in almost every category of funding that's in this bill, my Republican colleagues have already voted for aid in the last two rescue packages that we did. We wouldn't have to keep doing this if we voted for, like we did, if we voted for a package that was large enough. If we had done this in the beginning, we wouldn't have had to do this now.
Exactly. And it is a popular bill, even among Republicans throughout the country. So it is a bit surprising, wouldn't you say, that no Republicans voted for the bill either in the Senate or the House of Representatives?
Well, I think that's sad because, again, they have voted for most of these provisions before, and the American people are still hurting. So to not provide the relief that Americans need at their time of need, I think is very sad.
Congresswoman Bass, in addition to checks for all but the highest earning adults in this country, there's going to be a lot of money for children, support for unemployed workers continuing to get $300 a week through September. State and city governments will be getting help that they need. It includes tens of billions of dollars to fund coronavirus testing and contact tracing, of course, as well as vaccine distribution. But it also is seen as a bill that is tantamount to the expansion of the government social safety net and perhaps cutting child poverty to such a degree that we haven't seen, you know, possibly since the time of the Depression. How do you see these larger aspects of the bill?
Well, they're all connected, and you're absolutely right to compare it to the Depression, because in many communities, especially communities of color, it is a depression right now. In terms of the people who are the first laid off on their jobs, you're talking about people who are of lower income, people who are of lower wealth. And so to provide and expand the safety net right now, that's exactly when you need the safety net. So I think it was absolutely the right thing to do. I'm very proud of what we've done, and I'm proud that the American people will receive some relief. So just think about it this way. We provided a safety net at the same time as we poured billions and billions of dollars into vaccines. So the president has promised by the end of May that every American that wants to have a vaccine will have a vaccine. That way, we will be able to completely open up our economy again. Now, one of my colleagues' major complaints is that we need to open up the schools. Well, $7 billion was provided for vaccines. We can make sure that teachers get vaccinated, but we also provided billions of dollars for local and state governments, as you've described. Well, who do you think provides resources to schools? When you provide money for local and state government, that will help the schools so that they can open up. They can deal with their ventilation systems. They can provide for personal protective gear for teachers and also for vaccines. So it was absolutely the right thing to do. And anything that's going to cut child poverty in the 21st century, in the richest country in the history of the world, I want to know why we have child poverty.
Congresswoman Bass, this is no question a very important linchpin in the Biden-Harris agenda, getting this bill passed. But President Biden wants to continue to move forward. He has immigration reform on his plate, infrastructure development, fighting what can be increasingly called voter suppression laws. And many Democrats worry that this could run into an impasse in the closely divided 50-50 Senate, you know, where it takes 60 votes to cut off debate on most measures. Despite the momentum we're seeing with this bill, how concerned are you about the future of these items on President Biden's agenda and probably on the House Democratic agenda?
Well, I am very concerned about it because you would think that in the world's greatest democracy, that my Republican colleagues would want to do everything to make sure that everybody can vote. Don't we go around the world preaching democracy, preaching voting rights? And then for the entire world to see that what is going on here is that we believe in the right to vote, but only of certain people. And we want to prevent people from voting, African Americans, older people, other communities of color, students. We're actually looking for ways to prevent them from voting. That's what's happening on the other side of the aisle. And frankly, I think it's shameful in our democracy that we don't do everything possible to make it easier for people to vote. One of the most important bills that we have to pass is the John Lewis Voting Rights Act. And that's because the Supreme Court gutted the Voting Rights Act several years ago, and the whole civil rights movement was based on civil rights and voting rights. And so our colleague, Representative John Lewis, who passed away a year ago, we named the bill after him. And so I think to regain our standing in the world and our ability to preach democracy around the world, we have to make sure that we take care of home first. And so I think that's one of the most important bills for us to pass. Unfortunately, since the election did not go the way the Republicans wanted, in states all across the country with Republican legislatures and Republican governors, they are passing laws immediately to limit voting so that the people that don't support them won't be able to access the ballot.
Indeed, we are seeing this troubling trend. So I don't suppose you're very optimistic about the passage of the John Lewis Voting Rights Act.
I didn't say that. I'm actually optimistic because I know that my colleagues realize that the whole world is watching. And we've been embarrassed in front of the world for quite a while now. So with a new administration that understands that the United States cannot function in a vacuum, and if we want to be the leader of the world, then we have to act like it, and we have to do what we're demanding of other people around the world. And so I believe that my Republican colleagues, at least in the Senate, will see the light and vote the right way. Now, if they don't, then we're going to have to look at the rules of the Senate and figure out a way to get that bill passed, because frankly, our democracy is going to be crippled if state laws are allowed to go into effect that are specifically targeted at Black, Brown, Asian, and Native American populations to limit our access to the ballot.
Exactly. And as we mentioned, the COVID relief bill was passed on a party line vote through a mechanism called reconciliation that allowed it to pass through the majority, which were the Democrats, and any future legislation could be much more difficult.
Well, right. And understand that when they voted for the $1.9 trillion in tax cuts for the most wealthiest Americans, they used the Budget Reconciliation Act. The difference this time is we're voting $1.9 trillion for the American people to put money directly in the pockets of people who are struggling right now, not giving money to the people who are the most wealthiest people in the country, and then hoping that it trickles down to people who do not have the same level of wealth. We've tried that, we've said that over and over again, and somehow that trickle down never happens.
Congresswoman Bass, earlier you referred to polarization. The Republicans in particular don't seem to want to come to the table on certain issues. And we're seeing more polarization in the aftermath of the 2020 elections, where former President Trump still cannot admit his loss, and a large number of Republicans continue to perpetuate what is being called the big lie that former President Trump won. That very falsehood helped incite the insurrection at the Capitol on January 6th. What's your take on what is a growing threat from the spreading of disinformation, falsehoods, and the threat from domestic extremists like the Proud Boys, Oath Keepers, Three Percenters, and other assorted white supremacists and anti-government militias, some of whom are members of the military or police?
Well, frankly, for many of us from communities of color, it is not surprising to know that there are white supremacists that are in law enforcement and in the military, because our communities have suffered from that for many, many years. I think it's sad. Unfortunately, the former president essentially became a cult-like leader with a cult-like following. And oftentimes, if you're in an organization like that and you step out of line, you get punished. To know that there were white supremacists that attacked the Capitol, I was here that day. I think it was one of the darkest days in U.S. history, one of the saddest days in U.S. history to have this happen. And in addition to denying that the election was actually fair, my Republican colleagues are also denying that an insurrection took place at all. They want to downplay it. Why? Because when it comes to domestic terrorism, they only acknowledge domestic terrorists if they are not white. For example, if the people that had attacked the Capitol were of Middle Eastern origin, if they were Latino, if they were African American, they'd be up in arms calling them domestic terrorists and all. They don't even want to use that name when it comes to terrorists that are white. But that is a part of U.S. history. The Ku Klux Klan has been around for well over a century, almost a couple of centuries now. And if you want to talk about a domestic terrorist organization that led the way, that led to lynchings and executions of Black people in the South, it was the Ku Klux Klan. At no time were they ever referred to as domestic terrorists. And so now one of the things that we have to bring to light, because the entire world is watching us, we can't hide anymore. We have to acknowledge the shortcomings in our own country. To me, that's the way we can stand up with dignity and not look like hypocrites on the world stage, is to acknowledge we have some problems here. Now, the strength of our democracy is that as a member of Congress, I can sit here and tell you this, and I'm not worried about somebody knocking the door down and either beating me up or putting me in jail. I do have the freedom to criticize my country. I have the freedom to be a member of Congress and pass legislation that is critical of the country. That is the strength of our democracy. But when we do have problems, we need to acknowledge them and we need to rectify them. And if we get anything out of January 6th, I am hoping that we will finally acknowledge the problem of white supremacy in the United States. Unfortunately, over the last 4 years, we had white supremacy in the White House. Now that that is gone, the remnants are still there, and we're going to suffer the consequences. Unfortunately, the last administration essentially fomented this, one through saying that the election was stolen, all of the things, the entire playbook that we take around the world and we tell the world not to do. You know, don't use hate language. Don't say the election was stolen. Cooperate with courts. Well, over 60 courts with judges that were appointed by the last president, over 60 cases were dismissed as being fraudulent. So at some point in time, you have to admit the truth. Again, this is what we tell the rest of the world. We need to maintain the standards that we hold everybody else up to.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our special guest is Congresswoman Karen Bass, Democrat from the state of California. She also chairs the Subcommittee on Africa, Global Health, and Global Human Rights. She's been the top Democrat on that committee since 2011. I'm Carol Castiel. This is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel VOA. Here's a shout out to a very loyal listener and Facebook fan, Ejuxman Ejux from Calabar in southern Nigeria. Thanks so much for always writing in and commenting on Facebook. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Also, tune in to this weekend's Encounter, an update on the COVID-19 crisis and its political and economic implications in Latin America, with a special focus on Venezuela and Brazil. That's Encounter this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America. And now back to our special guest, Congresswoman Karen Bass, Democrat from the state of California. Congresswoman Bass, before we get into your work, particularly with respect to Africa, I wanted to ask you one more question, especially with regard to policing. Congresswoman Bass, as the lead author of the George Floyd Justice in Policing Act, that's supposed to address the, you know, the very types of biases and racial profiling and excessive use of force in our police force, I'd like you to talk about the importance of that act and prospects for its passage.
Well, I will tell you that many generations of African Americans have protested the unequal justice system that we have in our country. Policing in communities that are primarily Black and brown is completely different than policing in communities that are white and more affluent. In those communities, police are there to protect and serve. In our communities, they come in with more of a warrior type mentality. And so when the world witnessed the torture and execution of George Floyd, you noticed that that police officer was looking straight at the camera with his hand in his pocket, because he felt he could kill that Black man with complete impunity. He didn't have to worry about being sued. He didn't have to worry about being prosecuted. In the United States, we have over 18,000 police departments. There are no national standards or accreditation process for police departments. Individual police officers have to go through training, but there are no national standards. And so the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act, number one, takes away the ability for police officers to brutalize or kill with impunity. They can be sued, they will be prosecuted, and we call for standards to raise the level of policing in the United States. We banned chokeholds. We banned no-knock warrants, which is what killed Breonna Taylor, which means that the police just burst into her house in the middle of the night. Well, guess what? They had the wrong house. Chokeholds, we saw a knee hold that killed George Floyd, but Eric Gardner, who was detained by police on video camera, literally choked to death on video camera in a chokehold because he committed the crime of selling cigarettes illegally out in front of a store. It's that type of behavior that we want to change. So, for example, in some cities, chokeholds are legal. In other cities, they're not. And so we want to raise the national standards for federal policing. Now, as the U.S., as the federal government, we cannot dictate to states or municipalities. But I will tell you that after George Floyd's murder and after protests all around the world, the African ambassadors, all 50 plus ambassadors, protested at the UN over what was happening in the United States. The worldwide movement gave us the momentum in Congress to pass the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act. It's in the Senate now, and we're working on agreements because when a bill moves from one house to the next, changes are made. So we're in the process of discussing those changes right now. I am confident that we will get a bill on President Biden's desk because he has made this issue a top priority of his administration.
Congresswoman Bass is chair of the Subcommittee on Africa Global Health and Global Human Rights. I know that you are committed to resetting the U.S. alliance with the continent of Africa, and that would include greater U.S. support for the Africa Union and potentially an African Continental Free Trade Agreement. Talk about your priorities or what you think should be the priorities for the Biden-Harris administration with respect to Africa.
Well, first of all, I was so excited that within the first month of being president, that President Biden and Vice President Harris reached out to the African Union. And I know here in the U.S., in Congress, along with Chairman Greg Meeks, the House Foreign Affairs Committee chairman, and I chair the subcommittee, we did a two-hour Zoom call with all of the ambassadors from the African countries that are based here in Washington, D.C., to say that America is back. We understand the significance of the African continent, and we're going to get our foreign policy back on track. Personally, I prefer the policies of the Obama-Biden administration that said we want to change the paradigm away from viewing Africa from a charity perspective and to view Africa from a partnership perspective and acknowledge and respect all that Africa has to offer the United States. And so I'm looking forward to focusing on trade and development, supporting the Africa Free Trade Agreement, thinking about the reauthorization of AGOA several years from now, and really repairing the relationship between the United States and the continent.
And talking about foreign affairs and other issues which are of great interest and concern to you, what about immigration reform? And that also touches on Africans because many of them are immigrants to this country. Recently, you joined Congresswoman Linda Sanchez in introducing what is called the Bicameral U.S. Citizenship Act of 2021, yes, right, to overhaul American immigration system. What are the main provisions of the Citizenship Act? And to what extent is it different or complementary to President Biden's larger immigration overhaul proposal?
Well, it is President Biden's overall immigration proposal. And in terms of the pieces of the bill that directly relate to the Africans, one, the primary way Africans come to the United States is diversity visas, and we've increased those by a massive amount. I think we've increased them by 20,000 new visas. Temporary protective status for African immigrants that are here requesting asylum, we have increased that as well. You won't find the brutal discrimination that took place in the last administration where, as part of the policy, it was to deter people from coming to the country. We took their children away. To me, it was just unimaginable to travel. And I know Africans, especially from Cameroon and from several African countries, fly to Ecuador and literally walk from Ecuador to the U.S. border. I just can't even imagine what that journey must be like. And so I am hopeful with the Biden administration that instead of punishing people in such a ruthless manner, that we will actually focus on addressing the root causes as to why people leave their countries anyway. Some people in the United States believe that everybody in the world wants to be here. I don't hold that belief. I believe that people much prefer to stay at home, but they leave their countries because they have no choice. And so if we can help those countries resolve the problems, whether it's conflict, whether it's climate related, whether it's economic, whatever it is, then it contributes to world peace, and people can come to the United States when they choose to, as opposed to coming to the United States because they feel they have no way to survive unless they leave their countries.
Well, speaking of that, there has been bipartisanship on immigration reform in the past. We can go back to 2013. But speaking of this important immigration reform, Congresswoman Bass, what are the prospects that all of it, or at least pieces of it, citizenship for the 11 million documented workers, that is a pathway to citizenship, or the Dreamers, the so-called DACA recipients?
I think that we are approaching the bill from the comprehensive approach right now. We don't want to have the bill broken apart. And so we will see. I mean, we're just barely beginning this process. I'll have a much better sense in the next couple of weeks. But we are going to push for a comprehensive reform of immigration. And we've done that before. We just need to do it again. And a bipartisan bill passed out of the Senate just a few years ago. We need it to happen again.
Congresswoman Karen Bass is a Democrat from the state of California. Congresswoman Bass, thanks again for your time and terrific insights. On the anniversary of the World Health Organization declaring the coronavirus a global pandemic, and after signing the American Rescue Act into law, President Biden spoke to the American people. In his first primetime address, the president recognized and mourned the loss of more than 525,000 Americans to COVID-19. He marked the considerable progress made toward defeating the pandemic and asked for continued help with the challenges ahead. Here is VOA White House correspondent Patsy Wittakuswara summarizing President Biden's remarks to the American people.
It has been a year since the World Health Organization declared COVID-19 as a global pandemic. Since then, more than 2.6 million people have died around the world, 530,000 of them in the United States.
We all lost something, a collective suffering, a collective sacrifice, a year filled with the loss of life and the loss of living for all of us.
In his first primetime address Thursday, on the 50th day of his term, President Joe Biden outlined the steps his administration is taking to defeat the virus.
We're actually on track to reach this goal of 100 million shots in arms on my 60th day in office. No other country in the world has done this.
Biden said he is directing all states to make all American adults eligible to get the vaccine by the 1st of May. But he is facing a number of challenges, including vaccine hesitancy among some Americans and state governments ignoring federal health protocol guidelines, including Texas, which recently lifted its mask mandate.
A mask, the easiest thing to do to save lives. Sometimes it divides us. States pitted against one another instead of working with each other.
Analysts say divided views on vaccines and health protocols have been caused by politicization, particularly during the early days of the pandemic. Catherine Baker is dean at the Harris School of Public Policy at the University of Chicago.
People have been getting such mixed messages about public health, and the climate has been so polarized that there is a really distressing lack of public faith in science, in public health messaging. It's really understandable given the mixed messages that people have heard, but I think it's one of the lasting harms that's been done.
Earlier Thursday, Biden signed a $1.9 trillion coronavirus relief bill into law. The stimulus package was passed by Congress without Republican support. Republican House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy.
This isn't a rescue bill. It isn't a relief bill. It's a laundry list of left-wing priorities that predate the pandemic.
Biden will travel the country next week to tout the law bringing COVID-19 relief in what his administration calls the Help Is Here tour. Patsy Wittakuswara, VOA News.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Gary Jaffe and Rick Pantaleo. Thanks to Ian Kelly for booking our guest. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on The Voice of America.
This is VOA News via remote. I'm Coral Bowden.